Hey y'all. How's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I like being a radio show. It's pretty good. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM. And also, my own website is scotthorton.org. And if you go there, you can find my interview archives, my whole show archives, my blog, my bumper stickers, my bookstore, my list of documentaries that you might want to take a look at. Not that I made any of them, but just collected them there. Articles I've written, whatever, all that crap, it's there at scotthorton.org. More than 3,000 interviews now, going back to 2003. And then, so that's pretty good. I remembered to say that. Also, you can follow me on Twitter. You could like me on Facebook, but I quit Facebook a few months back, and I posted a couple of things, like updates of the show times and stuff on there, and that's about it. I'm done. But anyway, so I'm on Twitter, though, at Scott Horton Show, tweeting hateful things about things I hate all day, if you like that kind of stuff. And then I do this interview show. It's mostly an interview show. I do a bit of my own news coverage as well. Well, and rant and raven. But today on the show, Dar Jamail is going to be here to tell us about Iraq. I kind of hope he's not going back there. But he knows a hell of a lot about it because he was an unembedded reporter there for years and years. And he has been back in recent times, I guess. Maybe a year ago or so, at least. I don't know. I interviewed him about it, but I don't remember what name. Anyway, and then Elizabeth Goitein? 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 Goi... something? G-O-I-T-E-I-N. It's like the first half of her name says she's not Jewish, and then the second half of her name says she is Jewish. That's kind of interesting. G-O-I-T-E-I-N. Elizabeth Goitein. Something like that. Anyway. Speaking of Jews, today's my third wedding anniversary. So, happy anniversary, wife. I don't usually talk about the wife that much on the show other than to brag about stories that she broke back when she was writing for Raw Story and all that. But, anyway. Larissa, I love you, and so good. I'm glad you're my wife. All right. Got that out of the way. And then Max Blumenthal. Also, speaking of even more Jews, Max Blumenthal, our good friend, is going to be on the show to talk about what in the... Let me tell you about Israel, all right? I'm going to let Max tell you about Israel. But I'm going to tell you about Israel right now. The reason that Al-Qaeda is at war against the United States ever since 1993, since it really wasn't even Al-Qaeda yet, it was still Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and the Azam group, and they hadn't quite merged together yet. I'm not exactly positive anymore how all that worked out. But anyway, ever since the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, Bill Clinton, you might remember, had just been sworn in a month and a week before, on January the 20th. Month and a week before. And then this guy, Ramzi Youssef, and yes, the FBI had an informant inside the plot. They pulled the informant out of the plot. He was actually the guy with the job to make the fake bomb. They pulled him out, and then the cell brought in Ramzi Youssef, the mad genius murderer terrorist, to cook the bomb, and he did. And he almost succeeded in knocking over one tower into the other. That was what they were trying to do, was if they could get the right columns in the basement, they would have that... The world, I think the South Tower, I forget which one they hit. I think it was the South Tower. It was to break at the bottom and fall over to one side from their point of view, hopefully toward the other tower, and knock them both over. Holy, can you imagine? And that one was in the late afternoon when both buildings were absolutely completely full of people. And all the buildings that they would have crashed into, too. And fortunately, only six people were killed, which is horrible that six people were killed. Don't get me wrong, but it could have been 60,000, okay? That was the plan. And thank goodness it didn't happen. But the point is, Ramzi Youssef, the mad bomber, he heard all this crap on TV. Maybe it was the Serbs. You know, yeah, whoever, go ahead and let murderers get away with it if you can blame it on someone you feel like blaming it on, you pigs. So Ramzi Youssef wrote a letter to the New York Times and said, I did it, me and my group, and here's why, too. Israel. And not Israel because they're Jewish and he just hates Jews. And not Israel because, you know, they're going about their day. And some people just can't stand to see success. Nope, that's not it either. It is the permanent occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. And at least at that time, the permanent, it only ended in the year 2000, occupation of southern Lebanon as well. Israel's unmitigated criminality against innocent civilians under foreign occupation. Remember the American occupation of Baghdad? That's been the Israeli occupation of the West Bank since 1967. 67. Longer than the Soviet Union occupied Eastern Europe. The Israelis have been occupying the people of the West Bank and brutalizing them. And I'm not saying that makes it okay or any stupid thing that some liar would have you hear when I talk. If you listen close, none of this is an excuse for violent behavior against the United States. But it is the reason why. You have to understand American support for Israel's unmitigated criminality and persecution of the people of Palestine is what has caused the terror war against the United States. And yes, along with the permanent occupation of Saudi Arabia, the unlimited bombing by the United States of Iraq from 1991 through to this day. I guess there's a small pause in there since 2011. But anyway, all through the rest of Bush Sr.'s term, all through the Clinton years, all through the Bush years. But, you know, up until 9/11, it was that was one of the primary grievances. As Gene Healy pointed out, Paul Wolfowitz even admitted it and used that as an excuse. Yeah, that's why we needed to invade Iraq, so we could get our bases out of Saudi Arabia by moving them north into Iraq. Oh, yeah. But that'll be fine, though. No one will mind that. Anyway, there's a great clip of Ron Paul calling out Paul Wolfowitz in one of the Republican debates was held at, I believe, at the American Enterprise Institute. And it was a National Review American Enterprise Institute type thing for the Republican debate. And Danielle Pletka tried to call out Ron Paul about something he had said about al-Shabaab, which, of course, was correct. But he said, oh, I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear. Did you see al-Qaeda? Yeah, I want to talk about al-Qaeda. Why, there's Paul Wolfowitz. And I swear to Christ, if I had written this script for a TV show, I couldn't. There's no way. You wouldn't have believed me if I had staged it this way. You'd have been like, come on, Scott Horton, that's overdoing it. But Paul goes, hey, there's Paul Wolfowitz. And he admitted, and he's the one who said that American occupation and the permanent bases in Saudi Arabia was a number one recruiter for al-Qaeda's terror war against the United States. And Paul Wolfowitz, literally, he has his hand palm up. He's got his thumbnail between his teeth, biting down hard, and literally sinks in his chair like, wah, 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 kind of thing, like some ridiculous TV show. Sinking in his chair, hiding from the crowd. Anyway, but the point is, all the way through, every terrorist attack on the U.S. since 1993, they've cited Israel. Including the September 11th hijackers were obsessed with American support for Israel's occupations in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So we pay for Israel's war crimes both ways.
Admit it.
Our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. Own a bookstore? Sell guns at the show? Get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to $1 apiece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I'm lost. Somebody emailed me and said, who are these guys talking? The only person talking was me. So, if he didn't recognize my voice, it must not have been my voice. And if I was two people, then I would have known that. So, maybe I'm not on right now. Am I not on right now? What the hell is going on? Seems like I'm on. To me. I don't know. What's going on in the chat room? There's a chat room. There's a bunch of people in it. Hello? Screwing around on Twitter during the break. Distracted. All right. Anyway, so here's my thing about it, man. American support for Israel is a major cause of the terror war against the United States. And then, of course, the terror war against the United States is the great excuse for America's terror war against the whole rest of the damn world. It's one of the major reasons that America cannot just be a normal country in a normal time. It's one of the reasons that the neoconservatives will stop at nothing to promote the American empire and all of its works in every way. Because Israel needs the American empire. So America can't be a republic. America has to be an empire. And also Lockheed pays them handsome salaries. All right. There you go. All right. Well, I got a text message that says somebody can hear me, so that's pretty good. Hey, yeah, join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat, if you want to. There's somebody's talking to me in there. Hi, number six. You are number six. Looks like some people are signed in there. I don't know. scotthorton.org/chat, though, if you want to take part in the goings on. So, anyway. The thing of it is that America should abandon Israel. And I only use that term because that's the loaded terminology of Zionists in American political debate. Oh, you just want to abandon Israel. Well, obviously that's a pretty biased way to portray it. So I'm saying, yeah. Go ahead, abandon them, and then see what happens. The truth is, they're not going anywhere. Hopefully, without American endless subsidy, especially with military equipment, and really, for that matter, all the cash is subsidizing their entire socialist healthcare and education system. I mean, what is this? Why in the world is America paying Israel's bills at all? It's insane. But, you know, that's the thing is, just like welfare, they're dependent. And they can get away with a lot more because they don't have to take responsibility. But if America wasn't backing them up, and we have no treaty with Israel at all, but we might as well. We have a de facto treaty since they completely control our Congress. Well, maybe not completely, but pretty damn close. But if they were on their own, then they would have to make choices like, do we want to have our commie healthcare and education system, or do we want to have militarism? And they might think of things like, geez, without Big Brother USA to back us up all the time and forever, maybe it would be in our short and medium term interest to start thinking about our long term interests and whether maybe we could have peace with our neighbors instead of endless strife and conflict. And yet they have no incentive to do that right now. And I think that Israel, I mean, the thing of it is, it has been the case in the past that at least the Arab governments, and I think, and it may be too late now, but maybe the Arab people could have finally gone along with the 48 borders. Maybe a recognized right to return, but not put in practice very well kind of a thing. But still let the occupied territories go back to just Israel proper, but without the so-called. And it would just be an accepted fact of life. Not that everybody in the region would be completely happy with it, but come on. They declared independence back in 1948. It's a state. The controversy now is not about the existence of Israel so much as the existence of the occupation. And, you know, you'll hear from Max Blumenthal later in the show, I think, his conclusion is that the occupation is never going to end, so they might as well annex it, but then it's got to be, you know, equal rights, secular state for everybody. One man, one vote, and all of that. And single state solution. So it is a controversy. I don't mean to say it's not a controversy, whether it should be one state or two, but it seems like the existence of the state of Israel itself, if that was the only issue, would not be such a controversial issue. I think and without American support all this time, I think they would have had that much more incentive to make peace in Lebanon, Syria, was so damn insane that Ariel Sharon had us get rid of for him back in 03. And with the rest of the region. And because after all, you know, like John F. Kennedy said in his big thing about, you know, we all breathe the same air. We're all human beings here, man. We all want peace and security in our lives. Maybe it's not everyone's highest goal at all times, but basically, if we can get it, and some dignity, too, we'll take peace. And that goes for pretty much everybody in the world. So, in other words, it doesn't have to be this way. You know, that whole loaded thing that, oh, you want to abandon Israel implies that, yes, and then the waves of Arabs would just push them all into the sea where they would all just drown in the Mediterranean. But that's just nonsense. And in fact, you know that phrase of push all the Jews into the sea? It turned out, and I guess I should have my footnote, but I interviewed the footnote about it. I mean, there was a whole thing about it. A guy, maybe it was even M.J. Rosenberg who wrote this, that the guy who invented that phrase, who was a terrible, Arab agitator in Egypt against Israel, was actually an agent of the Mossad. And this terrible enemy of Israel was actually working for Israel when he coined that phrase about pushing the Jews into the sea. That's not really anyone's agenda. Well, maybe ISIS. But they can, you know, team up with Iran again, like the old days, to fight ISIS, right? Like back in the Reagan years. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first, and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org, or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe some kook, you know, somewhere on Twitter or something is outside of this, but broad brush statement I'm about to make. But, you know, it's universal, I think, among just whatever, all human beings, that Nobody's in favor of the kidnapping and murder of these teenagers on the West Bank. They're just kids. And really, it's not okay to kidnap and murder, well, depending on certain circumstances, adult, settlers on the West Bank. I mean, they are trespassing in a very severe way. They got no right whatsoever to have those settlements there. But teenagers are teenagers, man. And although, for some reason, that doesn't count when it comes to the Gaza Strip. And that's the thing of it. And for the West Bank, too, about, you know, in Gaza, the majority of the people in Gaza are minors. So they're not even minors. They're the majority. Under 18 years old. The whole thing is just a giant juvenile prison. And anyway, no matter what, you know what? Even if it was, well, first of all, there's no evidence of who even did this, so far as I know yet anyway. No one has really proven that Hamas did this or anyone else. They're falling back on the whole, well, it happened on, you know, Hamas's watch, so they're their fault. It's their fault. So then what? So then you get to just bomb the hell out of Gaza? And, you know, see, this is how far behind I am on catching up on all the news this morning, is that, I don't even know, were they bombing the West Bank too? Probably. But this collective punishment, it's madness. When they had an excuse, not a reason, they had an excuse going door to door looking for the guys, ransacking people's houses, where they know good and well that the kidnapped boys aren't there, but going ahead terrorizing the crap out of everyone. They had an excuse. But then after the kids are found, what's the excuse? Who could say, you know, just outright, that it is moral and right to attack innocent people to make a point to the guilty? That's crazy. And the truth of the situation is, the Palestinians are not occupying Israel. The Palestinians are on the receiving end of the violence here. Soldier brings his kid to work, basically. Bad things happen. And murder's murder, and if they know who actually did it, then those people should be prosecuted for murdering the guy. Or the guys who did it. But as Jason Ditz was saying, it doesn't make much sense that Hamas would be behind this. They're already falling back on, well, yeah, but so it's still their responsibility anyway. So we'll just bomb the crap out of them and whoever happens to be nearby. And, you know, Americans, I think mostly, you know, obviously people listening to this show are much better educated on this kind of thing, in, you know, generally speaking. But I think Americans, generally speaking, they just don't really even know that, yeah, they're occupying the people that they invaded and conquered in 1967. You know, in so-called Israel proper, they cleansed the Christian and Muslim Arabs out of that land so that it's an 80-20 split in favor of Jews. And there are so-called Israeli Arabs that live in so-called Israel proper, but they have that super majority there. But then there's the occupied territories. Oh, and those people are treated as second-class citizens as well, by the way. But then, well, not as well, as second-class citizens, maybe third-class. In the West Bank, they're ninth-class citizens. They're no-class citizens. They are occupied helots. And that's the problem. I don't know how this can keep going on. It's crazy. No American president has the will to stop it. You know what? Rewind to 2009. when Barack Obama gave his Cairo speech and was sending signals like, hey, man, I'm the president of America. I got elected to do stuff like this, and this is what I'm doing. I mean it about these settlements. Stop expanding them right now. And I mean it about these talks. We are going to arrive at a two-state solution here. I'm paraphrasing. And then he backed down. He just gave up and quit. Why? Because that's what Rahm Emanuel said? Well, you better not do this, Mr. President, or else... What? He's going to run for Congress and oppose you in the House? So? I don't know. Anyway, MJ Rosenberg told the story on this show that he knew people in Israel who, you know, he claimed knew, sources knew, that Netanyahu was on the literal eve of capitulation. Yeah, and he had, I guess, you know, people in his coalition understanding that he had no real choice here but to go along to whatever degree, something. And Netanyahu, he's a pretty strong leader over there, you know, I don't know, they could call new elections on him, but probably, I don't know how far to right the whole population is now, but, you know, anyway, he was giving in. And then Obama did the trade and said, oh, okay, well, I'll back off on Palestine if you back off on the Iran nuclear issue. Oh, okay, you have a deal, Mr. President. And then, of course, they didn't back off on the Iran nuclear issue whatsoever. And anyway, it could have been done. And in fact, if Barack Obama wasn't such a coward, and he is, I mean, he's a terrible person too, don't get me wrong. But on some things, you can tell he knows what's the right thing to do and wants to do it, and then he still doesn't. And but the truth is he's the president of the USA. Simple as that. If he had just told the American people, never mind the Cairo speech, how about a Washington, D.C. speech from the Oval Office? Hey, all networks, I need to talk directly to the American people from the Oval Office, like Ronald Reagan back in the day kind of thing. Like Bush on the night of 9/11 had to tell some lies real quick. Obama could just say to the American people, hey, listen, one of the major reasons that Mohammed Atta dedicated his life to dying to kill Americans on 9/11 was because of what Israel is doing in the occupied territories. Why, look at this map. These people have occupied militarily these people and are colonizing their land and building giant cities on their land, their trespassing occupied land, for longer than the evil red communist Soviet Union occupied Eastern Europe. And that is why Mohammed Atta crashed a plane into the tower. Do you dig it? Is everybody reading me? So this is why I am telling the Israeli government they gotta get the hell out of the West Bank. And I need your support, American people, that when the Israeli lobby in Washington, D.C. tries to clamp down on the Congress and say no to this, that I have the hundreds of millions of Americans behind me. If we have to be attacked for being good and doing the right thing, that's fine. If we're going to be attacked and we're going to have to die for what foreign countries are doing wrong, those days are at an end. Right, Americans? He would have won. That would have been it. That would have been it. The occupation of the West Bank would have ended the next day. Ronald Reagan told Begin, stop bombing Beirut. He stopped in half an hour, and Ronald Reagan said, I didn't know I could do that. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Dang. It says here on Max Blumenthal's blog, Israeli government, not his blog, his Twitter feed, Israeli government and press knew kidnapped teens were dead for weeks, but kept the info from the public. as they're going around searching door to door for the kidnapped teens. And if they knew they were dead, then, well, I don't know. Maybe they knew they were dead but couldn't isolate where they were, but maybe they could. Certainly raised the question whether they knew where the dead bodies were the whole time, too. I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to let Max Blumenthal talk to you guys later on in the show about all this. It's a mess. He's really good on this stuff. Dar Jamail is going to be on to talk about the crisis in Iraq, which has a lot of moving parts to it, of course, but he's got a good handle on it all. And I just, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of, wow, what do you think is going to happen involved in the Iraq situation? But, well, I guess the two people that I'm, two or three people that I'm listening to the very closest on this, Dar, Patrick Coburn, and Mitchell Prothero, too, from McClatchy, Landay, too, these guys are all agreed that, oh, yeah, everything's about to get a lot worse. Everybody's still just getting ready, you know. It's like Bart Simpson pulling his slingshot back, getting ready to fling it. It's inevitable. And there's suicide bombings here, and there's attacks there, and there's clashes for some cities here, but it, no, the war hasn't really started yet. And here come the Iranians and the Saudis and the Israelis. The Americans, see, the Americans and the Israelis are not going to let Jordan go nowhere, man. There's a red line right there, if there ever was one. Oh, man. I don't know. Anyway, so Dar's going to be on about that. And then Elizabeth Goitein is going to be on from the Brennan Center. And they put out this press release thing this morning. I should sign up for that thing. Somebody forwarded it to me. The NSA Privacy Board thingamajig has come out and declared that mass internet surveillance of Americans is legal. And so she's going to break that down. There's a lot of new news on the NSA. I'm going to try to get her. Hopefully she can, you know, talk about some of this other stuff with us, too. Barton Gellman has got a couple of new ones. And I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to mention yesterday that Greenwald had said that, and I mentioned this on the show last week, that the disclosure of the big one, the who which Americans the NSA has been spying on, that story was coming. And then he tweeted day before yesterday that, yep, it's coming tonight at midnight Eastern time. And then later on in the afternoon or that evening, he said, oh, now at the last minute, the U.S. government has contacted us with new claims that we, I forgot how he said it, are trying to track down or have decided to track down or something. And so what that sounds like is, you know, they made a claim that, oh, if you disclose this fact, it's going to compromise this terrible thing that then we're going to be able to completely crucify you for disclosing an important thing, getting innocent people killed or whatever kind of excuse. And so I guess he's got to be able to say that, you know, in good faith, he's tried to, you know, track down their claims and see if they can see if he can verify their claims before he says, screw you guys, and publishes it anyway, which he has done in, I mean, almost all the cases. He has admittedly said, you know, withheld information at times. In fact, it seemed like the last time he withheld the name of Afghanistan, from which country is it that, other than the Bahamas, that America is listening to every single phone call there. He said, you know, they had given him specific information that specific individuals were going to get killed if he released this thing. Now, I don't know whether that ever panned out or not. Seems like someone would have made a big deal about it if those people had gotten killed after WikiLeaks revealed that Afghanistan was the name. So I'm not saying the guy's beyond criticism, but I do think he's doing his best. And you know what? If they're going to say, oh, yeah, no, the real story is that you're guilty of treason for revealing the fact that blah, 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 and they're going to be able to completely obscure the importance and the true narrative, that holy crap, look at the massive lawless persecution of the American people that the NSA has been involved in, then that would certainly be worth proving that their claims are false before going ahead or actually having to withhold one thing in order to prevent that. I don't know. That's the choice he's got to make anyway. And I don't know. I believe he implied to Shepard Smith that that he's contacted everyone, that he's found out. If I read it right, I may have misunderstood. But I believe he was saying that they have tracked down all the people who they can prove have been illegally spied on here. And some of them want to remain anonymous, and some of them are willing to come forward and comment on the record. Some of them want to comment off the record and all that. But apparently that's what's been taking so damn long, is that they've been tracking down all of the illegally spied upon. So, but how many people is that? Hundreds? I mean, it couldn't be thousands. Then again, I could have misunderstood him. It could be that it's thousands and thousands of people, but they only talk to a small portion of them. I thought he was trying to say there, I don't have the words in front of me or anything. I thought he was saying they tracked down all the people. So I don't know what that means. I mean, he sure didn't ask me. You know what? Someone, I think Fitzy in the chat room was saying, I should ask Dar Jamail. But nah, I can't let Dar, even if that was true, and boy, would I suspect that they might be spying on Dar, or might have been anyway. But I don't think he would want to scoop Glenn and Ed. I wouldn't try to trick him into scooping them. I don't know. Why not? I guess I could. Oh, man. Ah. So I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. That's what's coming up. Max Blumenthal again, of course, too. Coming up here, starting in a little while. All right, now, man, I got so much news to cover, and I forget what all. Oh, I know, man. I was still talking about Israel. Let me wrap up my last thing about Israel here. Everything I just said was an aside, because I'm still talking about Israel. But now here's what I have to say about Israel. Rand Paul. Man, I don't know. You're probably tired of hearing me complain about this guy, but tragedy in Israel. It's time to end aid to the Palestinian Authority. Why? Rand Paul asks. Oh, too clever. By half. Why in the world does America pay the Palestinian Authority? Rand, America pays the Palestinian Authority to keep the victims of the occupation down. They are, just like Hamas, they're the hired guns to keep the population from rebelling against Israel's criminal theft of their land. Oh, what a convincing narrative that Rand Paul has no idea who's occupying who over there, or who Abu Mazen is, Abu Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority. Oh, no, he wasn't picked by the Israelis and the Americans or anything. He's a true grassroots leader of the people of Palestine, that guy. Give me a break. And, you know, Hamas was created by the Israelis to undermine the PLO. And then, of course, it's turned out this way. I don't know. I doubt they were seeing this far ahead, but it certainly then turned out that also having this right-wing religious alternative to the PLO means that, oh, boy, we never have to deal with them. Okay, maybe we'll deal with the PLO, but we're certainly not dealing with these Hamas guys. Why, they're the terrorists and whatever. But it was the Israelis that helped to create Hamas in the first place, according to Richard Sale and UPI and, oh, what's the guy's name? I want to say it's Adam Goldberg or Adam something in the Wall Street Journal wrote a whole big thing about it. Anyway, Rand Paul pretends to not know what's going on. The only people who are the bad guys are the victims of the occupation. and whatever money America's paying their overlords to keep them down, we should stop paying because they're the ones responsible for this crime. It's just the whole thing is incoherent because of how dishonest it is. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. Coming up, Max Blumenthal, Elizabeth Goitein, and Darge Mail about the things that they know about. For now, you're still stuck with me. Hey, last night I did the Liberty Chat show. I completely spaced out and screwed it up last week. But last night I showed up and it was kind of a small audience, but that's all right. It's still a new thing. We're getting it going. It was Will Grigg. Uh-oh. Boy, I had to sneeze. Hey, it only came in ones instead of twos and threes that time. That's good, at least. It was Will Grigg, and it was Con Hallinan. Will Grigg on the police state, of course. And Con Hallinan on the Iraq War, so those will be up in the archives, you know, whatever, at some point. But if you were just listening to this show, you might not have heard him. But that's the thing. My show, Scott Horton Show, on Liberty Chat, Tuesday nights. What, are you going to watch TV? Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock Eastern at libertychat.com. And then, so-called, the point of the thing, too, is that everybody in the chat room participates in the conversation a lot more, ask their own questions and that kind of thing. And it's a pretty cool thing. And there are some pretty cool other people who have shows on there too. I didn't show up last week. They just took my name right off the list. But then yesterday I was like, hey, I already got two scheduled, so you better let me on. I want the show, man. Come on. Well, I don't know. I'd done two shows in a row, but I still had not memorized I was supposed to do a show on Tuesday night. I don't know. I spaced it out, I tells you. I must have been distracted or something. But anyway, it was good. Will Grigg and Con Hallinan from last night right there at scotthorton.org at some point. Oh, and at libertychat.com. Soon enough. Anyway. All right. Quick note, I'm not the expert on it, but this guy, Shinzo Abe, is a right-wing nationalist jerk prime minister of Japan. And, well, I got the headline here somewhere at least. This could be really important, man. Japan ends 60 years of pacifism. Shinzo Abe ends post-war ban on fighting abroad. Japan took a historic step away from its post-war pacifism on Tuesday by ending a ban that has kept the military from fighting abroad since 1945. A victory for Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, but a move that has riled China and worries many Japanese voters. The change, the most dramatic shift in policy since Japan set up its post-war armed forces 60 years ago, will widen Japan's military options by ending the ban on exercising, quote, collective self-defense, or aiding a friendly country under attack. Abe's cabinet adopted a resolution outlining the shift, which also relaxes limits on activity. I can think of one good thing about it. Okay, well, I guess we don't need troops in Japan anymore. They can take care of their own national defense. Surely they can afford it. And America can get the hell out of the Pacific. How about that? Let it be a Japanese lake. See if I care. Like that's any worse than it being an American one. Give me a break. Anyway, but yeah, it's probably bad. What'll happen instead is we'll maintain our alliance and our bases, only now it'll just be easier for Japan to get us into war with China. Great job, jerks. I wonder if Obama even knew this was going to happen. I wonder if his government had any idea whether they did a thing about it other than push it. I bet they're probably partly responsible somehow. Bastards. All right, and, oh, man, I got to get to the cops. And you know what? Well, I got the segue into the cops, too, is the other thing I wanted to cover. There was a thing the other day. A bunch of polls came out. Here, Americans, here's one of them. Americans' confidence in government down, as now 7% have trust in Congress. The Supreme Court is at 30. The presidency is a 29% approval rating. I guess that's not just Obama, but the way they phrase it is the presidency. How much confidence do you have in these institutions? And the thing of it is that then there was a MSNBC clip. I think the Liberty Crier posted it, where they were going over some other poll results about how the Americans do. Yeah, it was. It's on the LibertyCrier.com, not the, just LibertyCrier.com. And they talk about how, it was a Chuck Todd clip. I was going to play it on the show yesterday, and I was like, I'm not playing Chuck Todd on this show. But anyway, and the clip was, Americans, they don't trust the media, they don't trust the government, they don't trust their state governments. And I don't know if they asked about the cops in this poll or whatever, but there's quite a few of them that just nobody really trusts the government at all. And it's funny to hear liberals talk about it because their only point that they can think of is, isn't that sad? Because, of course, the state is the center of the universe and the highest, you know, goal of a human is to get the state to do something to somebody or some kind of crap they believe. I don't know. So, but I have the explanation, especially for you boohoo liberals who, you know, are lamenting the fact that the state has lost its popular sovereignty. More than anything else, it's the lies and it's the cops. Oh, it's the lies, the wars, and the cops. And they lie about everything, everything, everything. And the wars, they lie about the wars. And that's kind of a big deal, you know, to lie people into war, to lie people into staying in war, to lie people into giving up their son's life. And people are really sick and tired of that, too. And then the other thing is the cops. You don't have to be a criminal. You don't have to be black or Mexican. You don't have to be, you know, dressed like a punk rocker or somehow some, you know, marginal character. You could be anyone in this society. You could have never committed a crime in your life, never shoplifted a pack of cigarettes in your life, and be absolutely terrified of your local sheriff's department and your local city police. They're the stormtroopers of death. They are the soldiers quartered among us that Thomas Jefferson complained about in the Declaration of Independence. This is no way for people to live in terror of their so-called security force. And you notice that all its worst tragedies come from the people who still believe in it. You watch so much damn TV, you just can't shake the image. Oh, who cares about the dead hooker in the alley? No one, except the heroic members of the cast of the Law and Order Special Victims Unit. They care. The government cares. They're going to get to the bottom of this. Blah, blah, blah. Every night, there's some different kind of cop show about just how bad you need them and how much better people they are than you and me. And yet, in practice, what happens? In Purcellville, USA, in Virginia, Purcellville, Virginia, the kid was he was kind of depressed, and he was cutting himself. Okay, he's 15, 17, he's acting out. His friend calls 911. Help my friend. He wasn't slitting his wrists, apparently. He was cutting himself. Kids do that. Kid's got some troubles, you know, I don't know. Maybe he was going to kill himself, and his friend was really distraught, didn't know what to do. But he called the state. The cops came and shot him to death. And they just showed up and killed him. And you know why? It's because they know they can never get in trouble for it, ever. And so they want to take the opportunity to kill a human at their first chance that they can get. And so they take it. Oh, he's got a knife in his hand. Pow, 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 pow. And they kill him. Somebody's son. Killed him. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money. And see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. So, yeah, that's the thing of it. You know, when I was a cab driver, I had a young kid in my cab. Oh, it's been so long, I don't remember how old he was anymore. I guess he must have been 17, 18 or something. Young black kid. From the east side of Austin. And by the way, Austin is like Hobbiton or something. You know, this is paradise compared to a tough city. Where people are actually, you know, have to be tough. Austin is not like that. Austin is a nice place. Even the very worst neighborhood in Austin, you could walk there at night and get offered a hooker or some drugs maybe. But you might get jumped. But you might not get jumped. You know, seriously. I'm from here. But anyway, this kid told me that he was raised by his grandmama from the time he was, I think, 11. And all the boys in the neighborhood, this is how they were raised by their parents and grandparents from the time they're little boys, that if you can see a cop, make sure that he can see that your hands are empty or just holding a cup or whatever, or empty of a threat to him at any time. If you get pulled over, you put your hands out the window. Now, I'm a white kid from the suburbs of Northwest Austin, and I was taught that if you get pulled over, you put your hands on the steering wheel because these guys are jumpy and they're armed and they don't know who they're dealing with. You could be a black guy. No one ever taught me that. I'm just saying. But we're told, hey, yeah, you put your hands on the steering wheel. No reason to make the cop nervous when he's walking up to your window. Black people are taught from the time that they are prepubescent little children. You know, child menu age children. Make sure they can see your hands or they'll kill you. They will kill you. That's the reality of policing in America. That's the real life. That's the post-traumatic stress disorder of being a Fallujah known as a young black resident of East Austin, Texas. Again, one of the softest cities in all of American society. No wonder people hate you. You're the bad guys. The government, they're the bad guys. They're the predators. They're the gangsters. They're the criminals. And we're the prey. And what's changed now is, now everybody might as well be a black kid. That's how much rights you have. You might as well be a black male, say, age 16. And that goes for each and every one of all of you now. And your grandma and your little sister, you better make sure that they can see your hands. Because they might just kill you. They're like, you know, angry, mistreated, rabid pit bulls. That's what they are. They are dogs waiting for the chance to attack. That is what you need to teach your children about the police in America today. And then these people wonder why we don't believe in them when this is how they treat all of us. And here's the thing that the brilliant Robert Higgs said to me one day at breakfast. I'm so lucky I get to say that ever happened. I was having breakfast with Bob Higgs. Two times that's happened in my life, in fact. And Bob Higgs said, here's what we got. We got the cops getting worse than ever before, while at the same time, everybody has a phone in their pocket. A camera phone in their pocket. And at the same time that everybody's on Facebook and Twitter. And so almost every instance, every local story of police abuse that is in any way documented, whether on the local news or not, whether it's just somebody put it on YouTube, an individual citizen journalist, the victim or someone on the victim's side or innocent bystander who uploads it, and each one becomes a national news story. So now, if you have a Facebook feed, oh, and they'll tweak it for you and hide those stories. I don't know what you're supposed to have to do to get them to show you the stories you want to see or the friends that you friended deliberately or what with that corrupt thing. Join liberty.me. Click the right margin at scotthorton.org. But anyway, these stories get around. And each local story becomes a national news story. Oh, did you hear about, this latest one. Taser gun used on 11-year-old girl. Again, the mom's stupid enough to call the cops on her 10-year-old girl who is being disobedient and throwing a temper tantrum. Obviously, moms get fed up sometimes. She calls the police. The cop claims, and as far as this news story goes, there's no evidence otherwise. I guess it's believable that the cop asked permission from the mother and used the taser on a 10-year-old girl in her own bathroom, in her house. Electroshock torture. Pain compliance when an American government official does it. And then here's one. Paraplegic on his little scooter. Arrested, slammed to the ground. For riding against traffic like a pedestrian instead of with traffic like a motorized vehicle. The guy's paralyzed. Get up out of that wheelchair. Actually, I'm paralyzed. That's why I'm in the wheelchair. Blam! They take him down. You see how the police are actually the worst people in your town. The very worst ones. And I guess in a weird kind of perverted logic sort of a way, I could see how someone could come up with, well, maybe if we give the worst bullies the job of being the protectors, that'll sort of ameliorate the kind of bulliness that they... Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think we need a free market in policing right now. I think we need no government at all right now. This is what you get. Imagine that's your father, you know, in his 60s or in his 70s, paralyzed. Who can, you know, who's awesome, you know, stoked enough to live in this day and age. He can have an electronic wheelchair scooter good enough that he can go to the store by himself. And then the cops come and give him the beat down. That's America. And that's why popular sovereignty is actually, you know, according to this poll, a thing of the past. How are they ever going to get it back? It was always a lie in the first place. How can they ever get people to believe in them again? When these are the guys who would attack your paralyzed old father if they could. Your grandpa. Who, if they see a suicidal kid, if they're called to help a suicidal kid, and they see him standing there with a knife in his hand, they'll just murder him right there on the spot. Here, this one even made the Washington Post. I don't even think this one's by Radley Balco, man. This one didn't even by Radley Balco. This is just the news. The local news in the Washington Post. Teenager calls police to help his depressed friend. Cop comes and executes him. And, as you know, will never, ever, 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 ever be held accountable for it whatsoever. Ever. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking and war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest on the show today is our good friend Dar Jamail, former unembedded journalist in the last Iraq war. I know there's quite a few. It's hard to keep track. He's the author of Beyond the Green Zone and The Will to Resist. Welcome back. How are you doing, Dar? Oh, I hit the wrong dang button. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Hey, get a little close to that mic. You kind of sound like you're in an auditorium or something.
Okay.
Thank you. All right, so I guess let's go through all the bad news. I don't know what order you want to start in here when it comes to Iraq. I guess let's start with the politics. Is that all right with you? The parliament met for a minute, and then the Sunnis and the Kurds, they walked out, they took a break, they walked out, never came back. At the same time, it seems like Sistani and all the rest, any support Maliki had, has dried up at this point, but I don't know what else is happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the most important fact, that the fact that the Iraqi parliament met and that session lasted less than half an hour. When the Sunnis and Kurds walked out, Maliki, of course, desperately trying to hold on to power in any way that he can, but is obviously under tremendous pressure from both the Kurds and the Sunnis and the U.S. and probably several other entities to get the heck out of Dodge, because he's obviously being blamed, and mostly rightly so, for a large part of the problem that we're looking at here. So, you know, basically, effectively, right now as we speak, there's not a government in Baghdad.
All right, now, so help me out with this. It seems like if Sistani says, hey, we need a new prime minister here, then isn't that the end of that? How can Maliki resist that? Or do I overestimate the power of Sistani, who, after all, he usually stays out of matters like this, or at least certainly doesn't take this kind of public of a stand. It would seem to me like he would have that much more weight behind it, you know, like when Colonel Potter says, damn, and you're kind of scandalized. Whoa, he must really be upset.
No, I think you're right. Sistani is kind of the end all in Iraq. And for him to be vocal about anything is a very big deal. And the fact that he's been so clear about Maliki is should be a no-brainer. I mean, I think it looks as though Maliki is going a bit rogue in the anyone that would stand up and not jump the second Sistani says to jump is certainly setting themselves up for a bit of a world of hurt. So I think it is just evidence of the growing fragmentation and chaos of what's going on. And Maliki, you know, this guy's a despot. I mean, he's been behaving as such from day one, so it's not surprising that at the end of the day, when everything's going to pieces, this guy's he's hooked into the power, and he's had a whole lot of power, and he did a pretty good job of consolidating it throughout much of his reign until this current crisis. But clearly he has overplayed his hand, and I think his days are numbered.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest modern military rout probably ever happened on his watch. So it's pretty hard to live that down. And yeah, he's made enemies out of the Kurds. He obviously is, as Coburn says, he's just this hate figure. He's, you know, what Saddam Hussein was to Richard Pearl or to maybe to Muqtada al-Sadr is what Maliki is to the Sunnis now.
You're exactly right. And I, you know, history has showed us and continues to bear out the fact that any government or any political figure in a situation like this in the Middle East, like with Maliki, where he's essentially a dictator, go around the regime, whether you're talking about Qatar or UAE or Saudi or, you know, insert name of dictatorship here. Anyone that doesn't have military backing to back their policies, they're not going to last 5 minutes. And and the unraveling of the Iraqi army that we've seen through this crisis is clear that Maliki, you know, if he can't back up his words with a very, very big stick, he needs to find an exit.
All right, now, so let's talk about the Kurd situation here a little bit. Well, I saw a reference to, I actually didn't see the BBC interview. I'm not sure if you did, but I read about, anyway, apparently Barzani has said that he's basically making it clear that, as though he was ever really hiding it, but I guess he's saying now I'm going ahead and declaring that independence is the goal and that we're going to hold a referendum within a matter of months.
Yeah, this is a big deal. I mean, you're right. This has always been clear. I mean, the Kurds have never been, they've never tried to hide it. They've never been shy about the fact that from the instant it looked like there was going to be an invasion on, back even before 2003, they started making preparations on, okay, how can we secede? How can we become independent? And then started working towards that, and they've worked on it very hard all through the U.S. occupation and made great strides in basically distancing themselves further and further from Baghdad. But now they have, I would say pretty astutely, whether you agree with the move or not is a different story, but definitely astutely taken full advantage of the chaos generated by this situation to further their plans. And they have done just that, you know, there. But you know, this is then where we immediately or simultaneously get into danger zone, because you've got them selling oil now to Israel. That's not going to go over real big in the rest of the region. What Turkey's already said point blank, we do not want an independent Kurdistan because of all the Kurds and the problems they've had with Kurds in southeastern Turkey. And then how will Iran react? Certainly Baghdad was in opposition to it. We talked about last time, Scott, that, you know, it was just a few years ago that Maliki came to a political impasse with the Kurds, did not want them making oil deals without Baghdad being involved. Of course, the Kurds going forward with those independent oil deals anyway. So Maliki rolled a big portion of the army up to the border of Kurdistan and threatened war. Mm-hmm. So clearly there's all these forces against it, while of course Israel's supporting it because, hey, they want unfettered access to a very, very large amount of oil up there. But it's complicated. There's, I think it's another layer of when just, I think we talked about before too, the other week when the Kurds rolled in and took over Kirkuk, mm-hmm. or at least the better part of it. I mean, this is, I think, adding essentially what could become another massive layer of this conflict.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was talking with Mitchell Prothero about Kirkuk, and he was explaining about how it's out there on the flat desert ground, not up in traditional Kurdistan, and they want it, and they, you know, Barzani, I think I always forget, but I guess it was Barzani said, it's our Jerusalem, which means no compromise. We're taking this city. But then, you know, seemed like there was a big question whether they can really hold it. Maybe all they've really done is set themselves up for a real war with the Islamic State over Kirkuk.
I think they have, and certainly the
if not Islamic, with Maliki, he's got his own problems, but he's also no longer adjacent, right?
Right. No, exactly. No, Kirkuk is off the table for Maliki. Maliki's literally fighting for his political and probably physical life at this stage of the game. So that's, you know, Baghdad's out of that picture for now. But certainly, Kirkuk is a rallying cry for bringing more resistance fighters, more especially former resistance fighters from under the U.S. occupation against the U.S., from bringing those guys in and other Arabs, possibly even from around, well, maybe not the region, but certainly from a broader swath of Iraq in to fight for Kirkuk, because they don't want to let it go.
All right, we got to hold it right there and take this break. When we get back, more with Dar Jamail, former unembedded reporter from the last Iraq war and author of Beyond the Green Zone and The Will to Resist. Hang tight. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bus to Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes, and now in color, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office, and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at ScottHorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's MyHeroesThink.com. Okay, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 3 Eastern Time. LRN.FM. My own website is ScottHorton.org. And yeah, anyway, I'm talking with Dar Jamail, author of Beyond the Green Zone, heroic unembedded reporter from the last Iraq war, and we're talking about this one. It's really been pretty bad this whole time, to be honest. It's just that the Americans have, you know, stepped away for a little while, but now they're back. And I guess that's the next big subject here. The top headline today at antiwar.com, Dar, is that the U.S. will be flying attack helicopters in Iraq. They're up to 650. They'll have at least eight. It was just last week that Obama said, well, you know, we'll have, 300 advisors. Now they're up to 800. They're going to sell them 4,000 missiles. And they already have, according to the New York Times, armed drones in the air if they're not doing strikes yet. I don't know if they're disclosing or what. But, you know, anything more that you know about American intervention, what all you know about it, please chime in and then tell us what it all means for the future of this conflict.
Well, those are the most important parts of the day. And, you know, just bearing in mind, this is such a volatile, dynamic situation. I mean, we might hear tomorrow that they're going to double the troop presence. I mean, this thing spiraled so out of control so quickly. In addition to everything you just mentioned with the U.S., you've got Russia pledging support to the government of Baghdad, and that means arms and money. You've got Iran, Russia shipping jet attack fighters to Baghdad to be used. So it's clearly already a regional, actually even beyond regional, war that we're looking at there. And U.S. involvement is escalating dramatically. I mean, it's technically doubled in less than a week. That trend seems to be going up because at first, no, there was going to be no troops. Then it was 200. Then it was 300. And then now it's 650, then 800. So this has all happened in 1 week time. So it's really escalating. And then the fact that now, the so-called U.S. military advisors are now going to be flying attack helicopters. We already know that ISIS has been very effective at knocking Iraqi military helicopters out of the air. So they're clear. I mean, if you're in Baghdad, you're in harm's way. I don't care if you're in the green zone or wherever. That's just how it is there. And then now you've got these guys. Clearly, they're going to be going out flying helicopter missions in what is essentially a war. So it's on. We can say that. And I think at this point, I'm going to be surprised if we don't see all of these numbers. If you're talking about Hellfire missiles or helicopter pilots or quote unquote support troops on the ground and funding, if we don't see all that continue to escalate, I'm going to be pretty surprised at this point.
You know, it seems like, imagine for the moment somehow you or I could make America, Russia, Saudi, Iran, everybody else stay out of the war and just let things settle. It seems like they're pretty much a stalemate. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't still want to fight about it. Maybe the Shiites are preparing, you know, a massive move all the way to Mosul, and they'll be damned if they're going to let Iraq break up. But it seems like all things being equal, the lines are already pretty much where they are. Hopefully nobody draws them in dark black magic marker on the map, because that means, you know, you have millions of people stuck on the wrong sides of the lines, Yugoslavia style. You don't want that to happen. But as far as, you know, here are the areas where the Iraqi army pretty much can't go, and here are the areas where ISIS, they can't really go either. Maybe they can do a suicide attack, but they can't really, you know, rule Basra one day, anytime in the next 100 years, right? So, and really the war for Baghdad's already been over since 2008, 2007, 2008. So it seems like, you know, maybe if all the other sides could stay out, that might be the best chance for things to settle out. And then, you know, obviously the the Sunni tribal leaders and religious leaders and local Iraqis, they're not going to let the Islamic State rule them forever. Not these, you know, Baghdadi and his suicide bomber brigades. Come on.
I think you're right. I think that as crazy as the situation is, that just stopping forcing the issue and let these guys be where they are, at least for now, would be the quickest and most immediate way to ratchet the violence down. And instead, we're seeing basically the U.S. policy of dump more arms, more money, more weapons into Baghdad. Just effectively, we're going to just, okay, let's bring a whole bunch more fuel to the fire and get ready to start dumping it on it ASAP. You know, once they start it, like you said, they may already be carrying out drone attacks. I haven't heard anything yet, but that could be happening. And certainly it looks as though it's going to be imminent. So more fuel to the fire. And it's, if the U.S. / Baghdad / Iran / the Shia decide they want to go in and start taking back towns that ISIS has taken and basically breaking up the caliphate that is kind of existing now, then we're talking about a major military operation. It's going to involve a whole lot of dead people and a massive amount of refugees and certainly a whole lot of dead civilians. But that looks like that is being formed. It looks like preparations are underway to force that issue, because it does appear that the Iran, Russia, the U.S. Does not have an interest in letting this caliphate exist.
Right. Well, and, you know, I guess the Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran has said that the shrines in Najaf and Karbala, and I'm leaving something out too. Oh, and it's Samarra.
Samarra.
Yeah, these are the red lines. And, of course, there's already been mortar attacks mm-hmm. on the Golden Dome Mosque in Samarra, like in 2006. Mm-hmm. I don't know, man. Well, so what about Iran? I mean, they said from the very beginning that the head of the Revolutionary Guard was there, that I guess there have been some reports of some Iranian drones flying around. What more can you tell us about Iranian intervention going on now?
Well, certainly they're very, very heavily involved. I mean, we have to remember that the U.S. Came out at least overtly, and when Iran made overtures of getting involved in some joint operations with the U.S., and of course the U.S. denied it, which actually probably means it's actually happening. I haven't confirmed that, but you know, we know what to make of government denials. So they're obviously a key player in this situation, and absolutely, probably more than anyone, don't want to see happen what we're seeing happening on the ground right now. So definitely, like I said before, they're rushing Iranian fighter jets to Baghdad to be used. Certainly there's going to be personnel involved with that. We already know that there's strong financial ties between Tehran and Baghdad, lots of business deals going on there, particularly when you go east of Baghdad, pretty much anywhere east of Baghdad, including Bakuba, and very, very heavy Iranian influence throughout Diyala province, especially right up to the borders. Actually, there's parts of Diyala province that are actually getting their electricity from Iran rather than from Iraq, and that's been going on for a long time. You know, we talked so much about, and rightly so, about Iranian control of southern Iraq, but there's very, very heavy influence on eastern parts of Iraq as well. So clearly Iran has a huge stake in this. They're going to be heavily involved. And, you know, and this is where it just gets so convoluted and insane when you look at the fact that Israel's pushing the Kurds to go independent to secure that resource of access to their oil while launching strikes against Syria. And then how's that play out across the rest of the region? And then, you know, Iranian and U.S. collaboration likely in Baghdad now. And just evidence of the total incoherence of the U.S. policy once again, where, you know, guess what? When you have total incoherent policy, you're supporting both sides, as the U.S. is with ISIS in Syria and the government in Baghdad, and then bring in all the other regional players. And this is what you got: total chaos, violence, a lot of deaths, and the situation looking like it can only get worse.
You know, Lande was on the show. Jonathan Lande from McClatchy was talking about Americans' support for the FSA and all the training of the vetted jihadis and whatever. Most of that is just, they're the border guards. Since America's undermining Assad's ability to keep the jihadists, the ISIS guys, out of Israel or and out of Jordan, I guess, is what he was saying. That's why we got to train up the FSA, is just basically to be border guards to do Assad's job of securing the border between Syria and Jordan. And then, as everybody is saying, apparently, this is the biggest red line in the world. Israel and America must get involved to protect Jordan. And they've already lost one border checkpoint on the Iraq border there.
That's right.
Man. And so, wow, what do you think about that? What if, well, yeah, okay. I mean, we're talking about speculation. What do you think, Dar, if Israel actually gets involved in Jordan, helping the Jordanian king's army fight against the Islamic State guys, backed by Assad? I mean, de facto, Israel would be de facto backed by Assad and the mullahs in Iran.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's mind-bending. It's really mind-bending. But clearly, one thing would happen if what you just said came to pass in Jordan. I mean, you've got radical Islamist fighters in Jordan who, for the moment, are against the Islamic caliphate being formed in Iraq, and yet, you know, if you start seeing direct Israeli collaboration with King Abdullah in Jordan, then it's kind of hard to imagine that's not going to change. That, you know, then you start, what happens then when we start having overt attacks, car bombs, and increasing destabilization in Jordan, which for the most part has been one of the more stable countries in the region throughout this whole disaster? Well, then we destabilize that. I mean, basically, I mean, it goes without saying, and I'm not, you know this better than anybody, Scott. You know, anything Israel gets involved with becomes immediately destabilized and violent and a hot button topic, and is going to inflame the region immediately. So it's pretty predictable, I think, where that would go.
Yeah. And, you know, I wonder, too, what threat to Saudi Arabia these guys are. I mean, I know they're getting their money from the Saudis, but so did Osama, and he attacked them.
That's a good point, too. That is. I mean, we can only speculate about that. But, you know, the U.S. knows better than anybody what happens when you go create these lunatics and give them a whole lot of training, a whole lot of arms, and a whole lot of money. Eventually, that chicken's going to come home to roost. So,
and that was always Osama's number one target, really, was the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, right? The corrupt, apostate, sock puppets of the West, et cetera, like that.
Right. Yeah. So it's definitely a very dangerous game the Saudis are playing, as are the Qataris.
All right. Well, thanks again for doing the show. I think we're basically making a weekly thing out of this now, and I sure appreciate your expertise on this very important issue.
Well, likewise, Scott. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks very much. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
All right, everybody. That's the great Dar Jamail, Beyond the Green Zone, into the brave new Iraq war now. And we'll be back with Elizabeth Goitein about the NSA, etc., right after this. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is Liza Goitein, and she is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here on the show. And I saw this press release that you guys sent out this morning. I guess, first of all, the bad news headline from AP here, Privacy Board, NSA's internet monitoring is legal. And
right.
Then you guys sent this thing right out saying not so fast. So I guess, could you please take us through their opinion and what's so wrong about it, do you think?
Sure, sure. So the program in question is a program that allows the government to collect the international phone calls between Americans and people overseas, and their emails with people overseas, without a warrant, as long as the government certifies that it has a foreign intelligence purpose and that its real interest is in the person who's overseas and not the American. But now, the board seemed to think that this was okay because some courts have said, not the Supreme Court, mind you, but some lower courts have said that there is a foreign intelligence exception to the warrant requirement. But no regular federal court has ever gone so far as to say that a program like this one would qualify for that exception. These have been much, much narrower cases where the target of the surveillance was a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power, and you know there were other limits in place that are just not in place here. So I think it's a real stretch for the board to conclude that this kind of warrantless surveillance is legal.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, I interview a guy named Adam Morrow from time to time from Cairo. And I guess, you know, I interview people in other countries, you know, pretty often. But he's in Cairo. And he and I talk about Egyptian politics, that kind of thing. He's a reporter for Interpress Service. And, you know, it seems like, well, I guess my question is whether listening to him say smart things in his analysis of what's going on in Egypt, whether that could count as an intelligence purpose. I mean, I'll assert to you that if CIA guys or NSA guys are listening to what he says, never mind what they learn about him. All they'll learn about him is that he's smart, but they'll learn all about Egyptian politics in a way that, you know, could sure benefit their understanding. Why not, right? So is that a foreign intelligence purpose that they can then keep? I mean, obviously, I'm putting our conversations on the internet, so this isn't the best example, but I'm talking about tapping my phone, keeping my call that they intercept in between me and him. That's a little bit different than the MP3 later, right?
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think the statute is very, very broad in terms of what it allows because it defines foreign intelligence as really any information that is relevant to foreign affairs or the security of the United States. And, you know, we don't really know how that's defined. That's not further defined. So I'm sure that the government could take a very broad view of that. So we really, I mean, in theory, sure. I mean, if this person is a non-citizen located overseas, you know, sounds like the content could arguably fall into the definition of foreign intelligence. If he's talking about, you know, Egyptian, you know, state of affairs over there in Egypt. So, yeah, I mean, in theory, that person could be a target, and that means that your communications with that person are fair game.
Now, under the rules of 1978, in the original Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, I think you were saying earlier, I don't know if that's exactly the law you were referring to or how it was, but it used to be they would have had to have reason to believe that the reason that I was on the phone with this phone number in Egypt was because somehow they were influencing me to be an agent of a foreign power, or at least the person that I would be on the phone with would be, what, a member of their government? Something like that would have had to have been the threshold? How does that work? Or how did it used to work?
Right, so the threshold is actually higher. It's not reason to believe. It's probable cause. So in 1978, if the
even
government wanted to...
Even for the FISA court, it was probable cause?
Even for the FISA court, the government had to show, if it wanted your communications with someone overseas and it was getting those communications by, you know, putting a wiretap here in the United States, then it would have to go to the FISA court and it would have to show probable cause that the target of the surveillance, which would most likely be the person overseas, might be you, was a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. And those definitions, too, are pretty broad. It's not just a foreign government. It's foreign political organizations, organizations under control of the foreign government, terrorist organizations. But even though it's a broad definition, it's still much, much narrower than the current definition doesn't even count because it's any foreign person overseas as long as the purpose is foreign intelligence.
And now in practice, though, even before September 11th, the FISA court basically gave out blank checks on all of these things. I mean, they didn't give out general warrants like they do now, but they virtually always said yes to the FBI when the FBI or the NSA came and said, whoa, we think this guy's agent of a foreign power. Go right ahead. We think was the real standard, right?
Yeah, well, so the thing is that whenever courts hear warrant applications in any context, and that's even regular criminal warrant applications, they tend to grant them. And, you know, there's a question about why that's so. Is it because the government only brings these applications when it knows it has enough evidence? Is it because the court isn't hearing from another side, and so it's going to give deference to the party that's in front of it, or it's going to be swayed by the party that's in front of it. I mean, this is a common feature of these kinds of ex parte warrant type proceedings, is that they go in favor of the government. But in the regular criminal context, there's usually an opportunity at some point to contest. I mean, not always, but usually to contest this, mm-hmm. to contest the gathering of information, because the warrant gathers evidence for a criminal proceeding, and in that criminal proceeding, the defendant can raise a Fourth Amendment objection. This doesn't happen in the context of FISA orders, surveillance orders for foreign intelligence purposes, because the person is never notified that the surveillance even happened unless that person is ultimately goes up on criminal charges. And even then, the notification provisions have been kind of honored in the breach.
Yeah. Well, you know, I work for antiwar.com, and as far as they'll admit so far, I wasn't part of it, but they were certainly using their FISA powers to spy on antiwar.com's founder and head writer, Eric Garrison, Justin Raimondo, and the ACLU is suing. Now, that's the first journalistic organization that it could be proven that they were using their FISA powers to target us on the bankrupt and ridiculous theory that somehow antiwar.com had foreign funding. It could, after all. So let's go ahead and use our FISA powers to look into whether or not, maybe, kind of thing. And it only came out in documents that were FOIA'd in another case. It came attached.
So part of what we worry about here is that in cases that involve some kind of international element to them, if the government can't get, doesn't have enough evidence or doesn't have probable cause of a crime in order to get a warrant, it can maybe get around the warrant requirement by using FISA or by using really the programmatic surveillance. Now, it's illegal for the government to collect that information with a U.S. person as a target, and that means a citizen or legal resident or, you know, a corporation, a U.S. corporation. Mm-hmm. So the government isn't supposed to have you in mind when it's, you know, picking up communications between you and someone overseas. But first of all, I don't know how you enforce that. Second of all, it's pretty clear that the government does have you in mind or does have Americans in mind because, you know, after going into court and getting approval for this program of warrantless surveillance on the grounds that it's not interested in the Americans, only in the foreigners, right? That's the basis on which it doesn't have to get a warrant. The government is right now running searches using U.S. person Americans' identifiers, their names, their phone numbers, their email addresses. The government plugs those in to this data to pull out and review their calls and their emails.
Is this the corporate store that you're talking about? Once it's made it through the loophole, it's in the giant warehouse full of data that they can search through all
they want. Actually, no. This isn't so. The corporate store relates to the metadata, the telephone records that government collects. This is communications. This is content that the government pulls in. So it has this whole pile of content that it got without a warrant because it was targeting foreigners.
Right.
But it knows.
All right, now I'm sorry.
Government...
We got to hold it right here. When we get back, everybody, we'll have more with Liza Goitein from the Brennan Center about this privacy board. Ruling, statement, something. Anyway, hang tight, just a sec. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Liza Goitein from the Brennan Center for Justice, something like that, about the NSA here, about the Privacy Board, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. They're voting to approve their report, which is saying that it's legal for them to search us without a warrant. And where we left off, our electronic data, where we left off before the break, she was correcting a point of fact here about it's not the corporate store. That's just the metadata where Once they've collected your metadata under any pretext of collecting anyone else's and you got caught up in it, now they can search yours too. That's a different scandal than this one. This is this the backdoor search? There's so much here, I can't keep it all straight, I admit, Liza.
Yes, this is the so-called backdoor search loophole, okay. And that's what Senator Wyden called it. And I think it's
and now this is all computer data, or this is my voice too?
It's both. It's phone calls and emails.
Mm-hmm.
It's whatever is collected under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act.
Right. You were going to say about the senator there.
Right. So, I mean, he sounded a warning that this was, I think, even before we even knew what he was sounding a warning about, because it was classified information, so he started out kind of obliquely. But, this is an end run around the Fourth Amendment, because these are communications that the government would have needed a warrant to get if it had come clean in the beginning and said, we actually want to get the information on the American part of the communication. But instead they say the opposite. They go and the government certifies that it isn't interested in the American side of the conversation, because that would be reverse targeting, and the government's not supposed to do that. So how is it consistent to then search through all of the communications that the government pulls in for information about Americans?
Right. Now, but here's one thing about the position of the board here, is that I remember when they passed the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, legalizing all of Bush's millions of felony violations of the FISA Act of 1978, that we all knew this. That was the scandal at the time, was, look, here's your hero, Barack Obama, Mr. Civil Rights, Mr. Civil Liberties and Peace and everything. Here he is voting for the FISA Amendments Act that legalizes general warrants in direct violation of the Constitution of the United States. And Glenn Greenwald wrote about it back then, and so did a lot of other people, and it was as clear as that. They were legalizing Bush's crimes, and so how could that be legal? I mean, the Constitution is still the first law of the federal government, right?
Right. Well, the theory was that, you know, it was clearly what Bush was doing was clearly in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And so rather than sort of roll back the abuses, Congress decided to roll back the law to allow the abuses to continue. The problem is there's also the Constitution, which the Congress is not allowed to roll back. But this is where things get tricky, because the Supreme Court has never actually said definitively whether there is or is not a foreign intelligence exception to the warrant requirement of the Fourth Amendment. And if there is one, how broad is it? What does it look like? And in the absence of that guidance, you know, the government is sort of taking that wiggle room and running with it. And it's definitely taken the idea much further than any of the courts of appeals, the regular courts of appeals, have taken it in their rulings.
Right. And then, so, I guess, is there some kind of compelling narrative that they put forward to justify this that's even worth kind of recounting and commenting on? Or they just basically said, you know, we don't want to make the president look that bad, and so we're going to say this.
If you read it, it all kind of hangs together. It's just a little bit strange, because I read the facts. I mean, one of the things this report does very well is it puts out much more detail on how this program actually operates than we've seen before. And it really provides a very useful service in that way.
Okay.
So I'm reading along and learning quite a bit about how the program operates. And then I read that same set of facts, and I think, wow, we really need some stronger privacy protections. And somehow the board, you know, looking at the same set of facts, just came to a different conclusion. And, you know, it's possible that the board was swayed by its feelings about the usefulness of this program. So on the telephone collection program, the board basically said this program isn't very useful. Now on this program, the board said, actually, we think it is useful. I'm a little concerned when I read it, when I really kind of parse what the board was saying, that the board is relying a little too much on, you know, assurances by officials. And there's, I'm not sure there's quite enough independent evidence that's cited, at least, to support this claim of how valuable it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wonder whether that is what sort of swayed the board. But, you know, that's not the board's job. I mean, the board's job is to represent the other side of the balance, right? I mean, there's the intelligence agencies are representing the side of the balance that says that we need to be, you know, primarily concerned with our sort of national security interests. And this board is supposed to weigh in on the other side with any sort of countervailing privacy and civil liberties interests that Americans have.
Mm-hmm.
And that just didn't happen in the way I thought it would.
Well, now, I think there are two different kind of review board things going on here, right? Is this the same one that had ruled that they were abusing the Patriot Act, Section 215?
This same board actually did say that.
Yeah.
This same board said that the Section 215, and there was another board as well that said that, but this same board said that the Section 215 bulk collection program was illegal, that it violated the statute, that it wasn't useful, and that it should be stopped.
Mm-hmm. And that's the one that you're saying that they also said, and yeah, we don't believe that it's been useful at all, whereas in this case they're saying they seem to be maybe relying on how useful this is claimed to be. For some reason, the fact that the claim of 54 attacks being completely debunked and whittled down all the way down to somebody MoneyGrammed some money to Somalia or something like that,
right.
That would seem to me like it would cause them to not just take the government's word for it on Section 703 of the other law, but I guess do what they
want. Yeah, well, it's strange because the report cites these two examples where it was useful. And then it says, you know, you could make the argument that in these two cases, the government could have gotten the same information with a warrant, basically. The government could have had enough evidence to get a warrant, and so it could have just gotten the information that way. And that may be true, but there may be other circumstances where that's not true. Well, why don't you actually cite the circumstances where it's not true? I mean, if the only concrete examples that you have to cite are examples where it really wasn't sort of uniquely valuable,
right,
then to me that's not strong evidence that the program is incredibly valuable. I mean, I'm not in a position to say one way or another. I'm just waiting to see the evidence, and I haven't seen it yet.
Right. Well, and then, of course, when the whole thing is to justify warrantless searches, it really doesn't matter anyway because it's a violation of people's rights anyway. And the worst crimes
right.
in America, quantifiably, would be husbands beating their wives. So we could put cameras in every, you know, two or three cameras per floor in every household in America. They're cheap enough nowadays. It could be done for the cost of one or two regime changes overseas somewhere. And we keep everybody safe. Except we don't want to live like that. And so that's a line they haven't crossed yet anyway.
Right, right. Well, I mean, sure, and if I knew it was going to keep husbands from beating their wives, it'd be awfully tempting. But, you know, the Constitution, you don't get to make those sort of... you don't get to say, well, but it works really well, or well, but it's convenient.
Right, yeah, there's got to be a line somewhere. Because, yeah, there's always a necessity is the argument of tyrant and the creed is slaves, said William Pitt, I think, whoever that is. Anyway, thank you so much for your time. You're great.
Thanks so much.
All right, but that is Liza Goitein, and she is at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law on the Privacy and Civil Liberties Board ruling report.
The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, APAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Keep all my interview archives there. And, you know, the whole show archives, too, and stuff I ever wrote and what have you. It's all there. Now, apparently, I have... I was trying to spare him the commercials, but apparently I put off calling Max Blumenthal for too long. Because now I'm Skyping, and he ain't answering. He must have thought, you're 4 minutes late. I'm out the door. Which happens, you know. Could have been a time zone thing, although I don't think so. I don't know. I guess we'll see. Anyway, I'll tell you what. I will go ahead and give a long introduction, and hopefully he'll answer. Max Blumenthal is the son of Sidney Blumenthal, who used to be an advisor to Bill Clinton, but more important for your and my purposes, wrote a great series of articles for Salon.com about the splits in the Republican Party, particularly the oil men versus the neocons type splits back in the Bush years that are very enlightening. You know, I'm not saying you have to agree with everything in there or whatever. pretty interesting stuff. If you search Sydney Blumenthal Salon.com, Bush years, you know, whatever, I don't know, you'll find it. There's quite a few essays. You know, Baker versus Pearl, to sum it up, right? Interesting stuff. Anyway, Max, he's a friend of mine. He's a friend of the wife's, too. He's a great guy. He's got a website called MaxBlumenthal.com. And he's the author of Republican Gomorrah, which is just about what a bunch of sickos the Republicans are. And then, but much more controversially and famously, he wrote this book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, which I put down for some reason, but stupidly because, check it out, I realized, oh, you can't see. I realize now I was almost halfway through it. So now I'm an idiot. Oh, good. And now he's on the line. So I can apologize sort of to his ear, if not his face. Hey, Max, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Good. Good. It's great to be back with you.
Good, good. I was just explaining to the people about how you wrote this book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, and as well as Republican Gomorrah. And then I was going to say to you, man, I'm sorry, because I read and I'm realizing now I was almost halfway through it. And then I got distracted for whatever reason last fall, and I never did finish the book, and then I never did interview you about it. And that's pretty crap, because you put a lot of work into this thing. And I was interviewing you all along while you were writing it about a lot of the stuff that's in here. And so I'm an idiot, and I'm sorry, and I'm going to finish the book, and then I'm going to interview
you. Yeah, well, no, don't worry about it. I mean, I had so many interviews, and it was so overwhelming that thanks to all the crazy attacks I got, that you don't even have to worry about it.
Yeah, wow. And so many books,
and, you know,
man,
this makes up for it, because, like, no one is injecting any sanity into what's happening now. No one's even talking about it, so.
Yeah. Well, listen, let me say, I really was enjoying the book. I admit it was very frustrating. That's probably part of the reason that I put it down and didn't pick it back up. It's just like, oy vey, on every page. I'm so fed up. It's just, I can't bear it, kind of. It just pisses me off. But, nah, I need to get it read, because I want to know what all is in
there.
That's
most people's reaction.
You know. Anyway, so listen, now I'm going to be quiet. You tell me for two segments, what in the hell is going on over there? You got free reign, please.
Well, thanks a lot. Really excited to do it, because we're not getting it from CNN.
No, I don't even have CNN on today. I'm over it. I'm not even trying.
I heard a comment on CNN, one of the, you know, Renta generals.
Oh, man, you know what? I'm sorry.
Israel's going to...
You know what, Max? I'm sorry, but we got a little bit of a signal problem there. Hopefully it'll iron itself out.
I don't know.
Try
where...
again.
Can you hear me, or?
Well, you sound pretty bad to me. Go ahead, and we'll see. I'll call it off if I have to, but.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Sometimes I have queens at my house. I don't know what to say.
Oh, man. You got a landline I can call? I got your cell phone number. I'm going to call you back on your cell phone. Is that all right? All right, well, call dropped. He didn't even hang up. We dropped the dang call there. Let's see. All right, well, that's okay. Now hear this, and then I'll be back in a minute.
Hey, everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the Journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, you know, they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
All right, you guys, welcome back. So I got Max on the phone now. Skype wasn't working. Looked like the call just dropped, so some kind of bandwidth. But anyway, so we're going to try the phone now, see if that's any better. Give that a try. Welcome back. How are you?
Good. Good to be on with you.
Okay, good. Now I can hear you. Okay, now I'm going to be quiet and let you talk for, 15, 20 minutes about Israel and Palestine and the kidnappings and the retaliation and the whatever you call it.
Okay, so just be clear when we're on.
Hey, man, are you driving through a tunnel in L.A. right now or what?
You can't hear me?
No, you just went mute on me for a good 10 seconds there.
Well, I didn't say anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, that was why. I should ask you a better question. Can you please give us the background to the recent bombings and the crisis in Palestine?
Stop. So are we airing now?
Yeah, we're on.
If you could ask questions, that would help, just so I know that we're on what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, yeah, we're talking about, obviously, Benjamin Netanyahu is bombing Gaza, and there are raids all across the West Bank, and the kidnapping of the teenagers, and as you were saying, there's been no media coverage of it, so I was going to try to give you a chance to tell us what you can about it.
Well, what's happening right now is that Israelis out of uniform taking matters into their own hands, and one of the Renta generals on CNN actually defended this and said, you can understand that Israelis are going to extract their revenge right now, which is consistent with CNN's resembling Israeli media. So I'm glad that you're doing this segment. Israelis have been organizing lynch mobs for the last day or two, chanting death to Arabs in the streets of Jerusalem, pledging to attack Palestinians, and there have been several attempts to kidnap Palestinian boys in East Jerusalem, which is the occupied area of Jerusalem, in revenge for three Israeli teens who were kidnapped and found dead in the West Bank, one of whom was a settler. And finally, apparently, a group of settlers who've been driving around in a black Honda Civic attempting to kidnap and kill Palestinian boys in revenge, did so. This happened in the woods near Deir Yassin, the site of a famous massacre in 1988 Palestinian. And the U.S. has issued condemnation, which came nowhere near their condemnations. This revenge was at the highest level by Prime Minister who blamed Hamas for the killing.
All right,
by
now,
Deputy Transportation Minister.
Max, let me stop you here. Your signal is going out on us real bad, and we're actually at a break right now. If it's possible, I'd like to just put you on hold through this break, and then maybe you can climb to the top of wherever you are.
I'm going to go to another room, but I don't know what I can do here.
Yeah, or just maybe get as close to the window as you can. Hold your phone with
as
few fingers
as you
can.
I was right by a window. I just have terrible service sometimes.
Yeah.
Is this any better?
Yeah. You sound okay now. So,
all right, hold on one second.
Let me go ahead. Yeah. I got to play these commercials. So let me put these commercials up, and then we'll be right back. Thanks again for bearing with us here.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here.
All right. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. Hey, it's live radio. Sometimes there's technical difficulties. It's all right. No big deal. We got Max Blumenthal on the line, right? Light's still green. That's good. Hey, Max. Hey,
can you hear me better now?
Yeah. You sound good. Thanks a lot, man. Appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, let's pick up where we left off.
Yeah, you were talking about some of these lynch mobs apparently found a victim there in Jerusalem.
Yeah, I mean, and this is following the arrest, basically the abduction of over 500 Palestinians, basically all people loosely affiliated with Hamas, most of whom have no record or very little record of militant activity. About 25-30% of those who were released in the Gilad Shalit prisoner swap were recaptured. Six Palestinians were killed. All of them were unarmed. Two Palestinians died of heart attacks during Israelis barging into their houses in the West Bank. Much of Nablus was raided in the north, although the bodies were found in the south in Hebron. Hebron was kept under curfew and lockdown. Several universities were raided. Israeli forces even made off with hundreds of flags, green Hamas flags at a university. Apparently waving a flag in the West Bank is an act of terror. And so they basically rampaged through the West Bank while bombing the Gaza Strip just as punishment for these three teens who had gone missing and were found dead. And it led to a huge wave of incitement from Israeli figures, including Netanyahu. In his official statement, he invoked the Holocaust, citing a famous poem about Jews slaughtered in Europe, and then calling the killers in Hamas human animals. His deputy minister, Tzipi Hotzavelli, called for eradication of Hamas. Benny Dayan, a settler leader, called for a war of annihilation. There are hundreds and hundreds of active duty Israeli soldiers posting photographs of themselves next to messages calling for revenge. Some have posted photos of themselves with masks on next to the message, "Death to Arabs." There have been mobs rampaging through Jerusalem. I previously covered this. I wrote about this in my book, Goliath. And I was attacked particularly by liberal Zionists, but also by Jewish organizations for a chapter called The Night of Broken Glass, in which I explicitly alluded to Kristallnacht, the attack on Jews in 1930s Germany, the pogrom against Jews by racist thugs, in light of an anti-African riot in Tel Aviv, where African windows were smashed by racist thugs who wanted to expel them and put them in camps. And now there are thousands of Africans in camps in Israel for the crime of not being Jewish. And now we see some of those same liberal Zionists comparing what's happening in Israel to 1930s Germany. The crisis has gone that far. And what I really want to do is talk about how the government and the intelligence services of Israel manipulated the killing of these three teens in order to produce what I just described, the whole wave of incitement and hate crimes and violence and the assault on the West Bank, which is deep in the occupation. I really think this is the intended result because it props up the right-wing government. And it actually also helps Mahmoud Abbas by crushing Hamas right after he entered into a unity government with him. So this is how it happened, and these are established facts that I've been able to establish. The Israeli teens went missing on, I believe, July 13th. There was a phone call that was placed to Israeli police by one of the Israeli teens who was hitchhiking. They were hitchhiking at the Gush Etzion, the Kfar Etzion, outside that settlement in the West Bank, which is 10 kilometers from Hebron. They'd apparently gotten into a car with two kidnappers, two Palestinian militants who had spent a lot of time in prison, whose relatives had been killed by the occupation, and who were looking to kidnap these teens in order to hold them as ransom for a release of Palestinian prisoners who the Netanyahu government had refused to release under the Kerry framework agreement, which led to the collapse of the framework agreement. And so immediately one of these teens calls the cops. His abductors see that and shoot him. But the shot is heard in the call to the cops. The shot is recorded in the call to the cops, and the other teens are killed. The Israeli intelligence service, the Shin Bet, hears that phone call. They have the recording of the phone call, and they immediately suspect who the two killers are because they have the West Bank on complete lockdown. The West Bank is heavily penetrated by Palestinian collaborators, and one of those who is accused of the killing is from a family, the Kowasme family, which represents a rogue Hamas faction, has very, very rarely takes any direction from Hamas. acts in contravention of what Hamas wants to do. And they had gone missing 2 days before the kidnapping took place. They immediately suspected them, and their names were reported in Palestinian media 2 days after the killing, because Israelis had showed up at their houses, Israeli forces had showed up at their houses looking for them. So here we have 2 points. They had the recording of the call of the shot, meaning that Israeli intelligence and police knew that the kids were probably dead. They'd been to the house of those they suspected of the crime, meaning they knew who the perpetrators were, and they knew that they were not acting within Hamas guidelines. Finally, the bodies were found in a shallow grave on the property of one of the families, which makes it likely or possible that they had the bodies, the Israelis had the bodies right away. But instead of informing the public of all of this and conducting a police action to catch the killers, the Israeli government imposed a gag order barring all Israeli media from reporting details of the crime, which I just described, including the phone call, and allowing Israeli leaders to whip up the government, to whip up their public into hysteria, to incite them to calls for blood revenge, in order to prop up this right-wing government and justify a widespread campaign against Hamas in the West Bank. And so 2 weeks later, after the hysteria started to die down, the Israeli government finally announced that it found the 3 bodies in a shallow grave. It finally named the perpetrators, and it finally announced that it had that it knew that the teens were dead all along, which didn't seem to matter to the Israeli public, which was just ready for revenge at that point. And that's where we are right now. So to me, it appears that the Israeli government has manipulated this killing for political reasons in order to produce the political and human catastrophe that we're seeing unfold right now in Jerusalem and across occupied Israel-Palestine.
To what end? I mean, I guess you said it to hurt Hamas in the new joint government with Fatah, of all, huh?
That's the most immediate end. And Mahmoud Abbas, the chairman of the PA, played along, providing intelligence to the Israelis. Palestinian Authority police even attacked Palestinian protesters attempting to prevent Israeli forces from entering Ramallah. So Abbas is part of this. And Abbas, of course, his fiercest enemy is not Israel. He's paid by them. He's working for them. He's a subcontractor for the Israelis. His real enemy is Hamas and any Palestinian faction that seeks to resist him and the occupation. So this benefited him. But there is another factor, which is Israel's international image, which is just sinking by the day. The killings through the political manipulation and staging, the Israeli government thought that it could elicit international sympathy. And it managed to do so from the United States, from the Obama administration, which is pandered to the Israeli government more than any American administration in history. I mean, you had Susan Rice, Ambassador Susan Rice, comparing the 3 killed Israeli teens to her own son. Samantha Power made similar statements, and John Kerry blamed all of Hamas, justifying what the Israelis did. But, I mean, I want to reiterate, and there's a great piece by Shlomi Eldar, who's a Israeli, I disagree with much of his writing, but he knows a lot about Israeli intelligence, and he knows a lot about, he's worked in the West Bank, and it's an Al-Monitor, and it's about the history of the Kawazmeh family and how they've always acted in contravention to the imperatives of Hamas, even while identifying with Hamas. And that's who's behind this. So it's deeply cynical what the Israelis have done with U.S. support. And it's led us to the current crisis. But I think that the more hysteria they can whip up in their own society, the more Netanyahu and the settlement, the coalition, which comprises the current Israeli government, which is heavily comprised of settler elements, the more they benefit and the more they can unite this extremely right-wing public behind them. Throughout this whole what I consider to be a staged crisis. Netanyahu appeared on Israeli media looking at maps, and you know, his team around him filtered reports of Netanyahu staying up all night, losing sleep over the teens, even though the Shin Bet knew the teens were dead. So this was an attempt to stage manage Netanyahu's image and make him look like this great crisis manager. Netanyahu is not respected in the Israeli military. He's not respected for in the same way that Ehud Barak, an Israeli war hero, was, highly decorated military veteran, or Ariel Sharon. And so this is a way for Netanyahu to appear tough and to handle a domestic crisis, because his strength among the Israeli public has always been his ability to manipulate and control the conversation in Washington and dominate Obama. So this is all about Israeli politics, and it's completely cynical to the core. And we look at who's truly suffering. It's Palestinians under occupation, and Palestinians in Jerusalem. And these three families of these Israeli teens were just used as political props.
Now tell me, Max, have you written this up yet? Or if not, where's it going to be? Or what's the deal?
I'm going to work on putting this all together for the Electronic Intifada, which is one of the essential websites, news sites that your listeners should be following on Israel-Palestine. It's electronicintifada.net. Mm-hmm. Another important website is mondoweiss.net. And what I want to do is put together just a factual narrative of how this crime, a low-level crime, but a tragedy nonetheless, was manipulated to lead to the current crisis. I wouldn't say a low-level crime. It was a murder, but it wasn't. I mean, this was a murder that was isolated and could have been solved and prosecuted through police action, and instead was manipulated to justify military action, something we're familiar with in the United States, in the post 9/11 United States, this kind of political manipulation and staging.
If they knew who the guys were that did it, and they knew the kids were dead, and then they came up with the bodies later, it's just as likely that they knew all along where the dead bodies were. Maybe even
like that, the dead bodies were in a shallow grave on the land of one of the perpetrators, whose house had been searched dozens of times by police, military, and Shin Bet. And the Shin Bet has the West Bank on complete lockdown. Like, every corner of the West Bank is known to the Shin Bet, if not to them, then to their collaborators. Just having spent extensive time in the West Bank, I know that. And I also know that Palestinians who weren't even paid collaborators would have reported the whereabouts of the teens just to avoid the kind of campaign of brutality that they witnessed for the last 2 weeks. You know, if you heard Palestinians wonder whether, you know, these teens were killed by Palestinians at all, it was because of that belief that the Israelis would have found them right away, since they usually find any Palestinian who throws a rock right away. A 12-year-old kid who throws a rock is going to be visited by soldiers at night in his own bed. So this is incredibly shady and just cynical to the core.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, I don't know if you mentioned this when you were kind of rattling off all the horrible consequences there. Did you have an estimate, or have you heard the latest word on casualties from the airstrikes in the Gaza Strip?
I think there were two. There have been dozens of injuries. The Gaza Strip was attacked, I think, 2 days ago, and within 10 minutes, about 32 bombs fell. It was sort of a limited bombing campaign. I understand that a rocket was launched into some kind of empty space in Israel. So there could be more bombings in the Gaza Strip. But the total of Palestinians killed in the Israeli campaign was six or seven, with over 500 arrests arrested, not arrested for any particular crime, but basically abducted. And over 200 are being held now without any charges. In other words, they're being held under administrative detention, sort of like people are being held in Guantanamo Bay. And finally, Israeli intelligence services have declared that all who have been arrested or abducted are ticking bombs. And under the Israeli rules, torture is only permitted if someone is considered a ticking bomb. So we can safely assume that scores of those taken from their homes were subjected to torture under the false premise that they were ticking bombs. And another point is that Israel has reinstituted its policy of collective punishment.
Well, you know what? Hold that point for a second. I'll let you go on as long as you want about that. But I got to stop you on the ticking bomb thing there for a second.
Yeah.
Boy, is that every torture monger's excuse in the whole wide world. And here in Israel, they actually have it where it's legal to torture somebody if it's a ticking bomb. And then when the rubber meets the road, we find out that's just words. And they could say, Max Blumenthal is a ticking bomb. It turns out that doesn't mean anything, and so therefore it can mean anything, and they can torture whoever they want. That's what it means.
Well, that's like an episode of 24. I mean, it's not an actual scenario that takes place. There's never been, in my knowledge, a situation where someone had had knowledge of a bomb that was that was literally ticking and was about to explode and provided the location only under torture. It's just, you know, it's something that we see Kiefer Sutherland do, but it's not something that happens in real life. And, you know, the funny thing is that this rule was put in place by the Israeli Supreme Court in order to limit torture just because it was such a widespread practice. And now it's becoming widespread again, along with the policy that Israel had briefly abandoned of demolishing or exploding the houses of the families of those who are accused of terrorism. So Israeli forces, after the bodies were announced found, arrived at the Kowazme and Abu Aisha families, the families of those accused, blew up their homes and prevented Palestinian ambulances and fire crews from arriving at the scene. And they're going to continue demolishing more homes of those who are simply accused of terrorism. This is another policy that doesn't work. A substantial percentage of Palestinians who committed suicide bombing attacks during the Second Intifada actually had their homes demolished under this policy during the First Intifada and grew up with that trauma and with the desire for revenge. The violence, any violence from the Palestinian side is, you know, seen as sort of manageable and beneficial by Israeli intelligence because it justifies harsher action, deepening the occupation. And one of the other forms of retaliation that Israel uses is building more settlements. The defense minister of Israel, Moshe Ya'alon, has called for memorializing the three kidnapped and killed teens by authorizing thousands of new settlement units. Many settlements throughout the West Bank are named after Jewish Israeli victims of Palestinian militancy. So it seems to me like there are many benefits that the right-wing government is reaping from this scenario, and it's pretty apparent that they manipulated it in order to bring us to the current crisis.
That's a sad story. Thank you for keeping such a close watch on it for us, Max, and I sure hope that, I'll definitely keep my eye open for whatever you're writing about this, and I'm definitely getting back to the book.
Thank you. And thanks again for having me. I mean, it's amazing that even shows like Democracy Now! Are not reporting on this. So I really appreciate you taking time to do it.
Well, there's nothing exceptional about it at all. It's just the news, man. Come on. I don't know. It's a sad state of affairs that nobody else wants to talk about it in any kind of fair way. But
it is sad. Anyway, keep doing your thing.
All right. Thanks. You too.
Take care, Scott.
That's the great Max Blumenthal, everybody. He's the author of the book Goliath, Fear and Loathing. in Greater Israel. Again, read him at electronicintifada.net and read him at mondoweiss.net as well.